Hello and welcome, dear listener. We are back for another edition of the Odd Job Pod. And because we've been away for a while, and what does James Bond do when he's been away for a while? He goes all topical. So like 70s Bonds doing blaxploitation, and like 80s Bonds tackling on capitalism and everything else that comes in the Silicon Valley area, we're going to use it as a little bit of a diving in topical and then going into probably something that's nothing unrelated. By which, obviously, the first question I'm going to be sat down and asking something which is very rare that I ask to either Graham Sibley or Terry DeFelin is, gents, do you like the new Bond theme from Billie Eilish? And do you feel down with the kids?
Actually, yes, I do. I must say, I've never heard anything that she sung before because she's for young people. I think she's only 18 years old, isn't she? I think so. Probably born in 2001.
Painfully young.
She is, yes, yes. And so,
it's almost inappropriate to listen to Billie Eilish for gents of our age.
It is the way you listen to it.
There's no need for that.
No, I actually really like it. I think, yes, it's another ponderous Bond theme. But then again, that matches the films, doesn't it, at the moment? This is the arc we're in at the moment. And yeah, I think I'm not sure it would have done with an all guns blazing theme tune. So yes, I must say I've only listened to it once, and that was in the bathroom this morning, and just as I was as we were preparing.
Yeah, in your bathroom listening to Billie Eilish.
Yeah, I was in the shower listening to it.
Dear God.
And I thought this is something I could probably hum along to, but it does sound...
Is that what they call it these days?
Yes, it is very, very familiar, but the song I'm talking about...
I think...
Terry, what do you think of it?
I think that I'm disappointed with the song.
Yes.
But, I mean, I absolutely understand why it is the way it is. I mean, it's clearly they've made a decision to continue with this kind of downbeat, ponderous kind of, you know, theme that they've got going. I mean, for me, it's, I mean, we played it, a little bit of it just now before we started recording, and with the first few bars, we broke out and started singing Skyfall.
The intro is exactly the same.
It's the same. So, but I'm also aware of the rather tedious refrain of people of my age who go, all these pop songs, they all sound the same.
Yes.
Which is a tedious refrain, and it was when I was a kid, and I'm sure it's tedious to listen to now, but I do miss the bombast when it comes to the Bond songs. And I was hoping that maybe we might see some of that. But we didn't. And it's okay. I mean, as a song, it's absolutely fine. She's clearly talented, skilled, great production, Grammy Award winning artist. You know, I mean, what's not to like in that respect?
I suppose so. I mean, but I suppose it's easier to think that all Bond themes are bombastic, or that there is a fine peppering them throughout the franchise.
Mm.
But I think if you go through after Live and Let Die, after Man with the Golden Gun, there's a whole raft of them. You've got to go up to about View to a Kill before you get another strong theme tune. Things like All Time High in there, and For Your Eyes Only, and Moonraker even. You've got Shirley Bassey in to do
it. I think. I mean, certainly Moonraker is understated.
Yeah.
And I get you there. I think probably what I'm more thinking about, maybe bombastic was the wrong word I used there.
Okay.
Yes, I would like to have a bit of blah-blah-blah kind of going on in with it. But, you know, at the same time, it's just, you know, you've got such talented vocalists doing these, and those songs for me, they're crying out for a big, powerful, long note at the end to just like give it some of that, give it some oomph. And I guess that's what I feel is missing from this current generation of Bond songs is this. They don't have that oomph. And that's, again,
well,
that's
Gary, what do you think? I mean, are we missing Gladys Knight and Tina Turner giving us License to Kill? Do you want to hear that?
I mean, part of me thinks as well that there's probably, like, if podcasts were a thing back in the 80s, and there was probably some radio station somewhere where there was a load of men, and it would have absolutely been men at that point in time, and still is, because obviously this is the industry that we're in. But there would have been a load of men sitting around going, oh, this Duran Duran, you know, what are they doing on a Bond theme?
I'm almost certain that was the case, because of course we were around then, and I'm pretty certain that actually the at the time that tune A View to a Kill was not as well received by Bond fans. I don't. I may be wrong about that.
And I think that's why they went all guns blazing on it as well, because there was a feeling that it was going to be something like, oh, look at these 5 minute wonders. And I think Duran Duran had been in the charts for about 4 years.
If that had been the view, then it would have been ignorant, because obviously Duran Duran were well established, you know,
and world famous hugely popular. As well.
And the song was massively popular and it's loved.
Yeah.
Now people look back on it and it regularly appears in people's top fives.
Yeah. Even though he tanks it during Live Aid.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I mean, he wasn't the only one to do that in Live Aid. I mean, that was a bit of a shit show.
They're all coked off their heads.
Yeah, and I mean, you would be though, wouldn't you? We want you to do a concert on spec with virtually no rehearsals and no soundtrack. I'm going to need some coke for this.
It was the 80s, come on. Yeah.
And with that, Terry has just described pretty much every Guns N' Roses gig probably from the early 90s. But I mean, I actually quite like it. I quite like Billie Eilish's music anyway. Like, she's played quite a lot over here in Australia where I reside. She is very popular with the youth of today. And I had it in my list, and it topped not this particular song, but Billie Eilish topped Triple J's Hottest 100, which is kind of like one of their big annual hipster traditions over here, and I was quite pleased. I think I had 10 songs that crossed over in there, so I'm kind of still vaguely, but I'm not young, but I'm vaguely there. But in terms of the song, I like it. It is very Adele into it. I would have liked a little bit of a punch in, and one of the things that reminded me a little bit, and actually was probably a little less Adele, although I can kind of see where it is, and it does fit the kind of music. And it was actually a little bit more, reminded me of Garbage, but without that kind of really killer kind of sudden raise up, because Garbage is quite, you know, World Is Not Enough is a very downbeat song, but then really kind of pumps in. And actually for me, like, well, it probably won't top too many people's lists. It's a song that I think is slightly underappreciated potentially because of the film it was in.
I
agree with that. But I am with Terry. There was part of me that was hoping for a repeat of You Know My Name, which I think is if we ever get around to doing, when we actually decide to do another Bond World Cup, and if we ever do one of songs, that one will probably be one that
I think I
would be fighting for heavily.
Me too. I think there's a strong field of Bond songs. But I mean, for me, You Know My Name is just...
Yeah.
Such a satisfying song.
Mm.
It's just so much fun to listen to.
Yeah.
And I will play that song on a loop. When I decide I want to listen to that song, I'll play it and listen to it 3 or 4 times in a row. I adore it. I really do.
It is David Arnold on Kitchen Sink there, isn't it?
Chris Cornell. I mean, and I guess this is what I'm talking about. Obviously, the Billy Art, No Time to Die, and beforehand, A Writing on the Wall, and beforehand, Scuffle, they are very different songs to You Know My Name, different genre of music. But what we're talking about, I guess, is, as you say, Graham, it's that kitchen sink element to it. The fact that David Arnold, who adored doing the Bond stuff, he just loved doing it. He's such a Bond fan, such a John Barry disciple, that, you know, he just like put so much energy into, you know, his scores and to the songs that he did. And it just seems that current thinking is a little bit understated. But again, these are creative decisions made. And also, in fairness, you have to consider, you know, where it sits in terms of what the tone of the movie is going to be. And I'm wondering, chaps, whether or not the song gives us an indication as to what kind of movie we're likely to be watching. He's going to die. Spoilers.
They're going to kill him off.
So you, when you say it's No Time to Die, you think that that's ironic because he dies?
Yeah, totally.
Gary?
Just be the same from You Only Live Twice. I mean, he's already died once in a Bond film. But actually, I think like where we've got to brings us actually to what we were going to talk about on this pod. And I think it's a nice win because, you know, we've picked up a few Bond themes and why they're good and why they're not, and start digging into other bits as well. And I guess with the new film coming out soon, No Time to Die, if you discover this in a few months' time, it's obviously out, and this podcast is horribly dated. This is why we don't do topical. But when No Time to Die does come out, it'll be interesting. And I think, you know, we obviously talk about Bond a lot. We have a lot of opinions on it. But you really dig into it and you kind of go, well, the difference between a good Bond film and an average Bond film and a not very good Bond film, there's a kind of almost an anatomy, a DNA to me of what makes up a good Bond film and what makes a really good Bond film, I guess, kind of beyond good. It's great. Ones that you just talk and they're the first ones you go to on your DVD. And they're always, I think, you know, if you kind of, if we dug into it, and this is probably what we're going to do over the next half an hour, 45 minutes, is really go like, what are the elements that, that make it great? And what for me, and let's start relatively modern, for example. So I guess I'll kind of go to you first, Terry. Like, if we're digging into the anatomy of a Bond film, what would make, say, Skyfall or Casino Royale, what's some of the anatomy in that that perhaps makes that better than, say, Spectre, which, you know, I don't think any of us dislike, but we wouldn't ever put in our top five lists at all?
Yeah, I think, say, for example, what separates Skyfall and Spectre is there's an energy to Skyfall that is lacking in Spectre. And I think probably the thing that strikes me that I always think of when I think of Skyfall is Skyfall recaptured that sense of wonder of travel. The scenes in Shanghai and then the scenes in, is it Macau? James Bond movies back in the 60s and 70s and to an extent the 80s gave people who had never had the chance to travel the opportunity to see the world, you know, through a glamorous
thrilling
filter.
Thrilling cities,
that kind of thing. And I think Skyfall did a really good job in recapturing an element of that.
Yes.
I think the fact that for a Western audience, like going out to Asia, for example, you know, it's still, you know, not many people get that opportunity to do that and probably never will. And you've just got that like slight sense of wonder.
Yeah,
And Spectre, I'm afraid, although beautifully shot, never quite captured that. So that would be something that I'd look to, you know, in a good James Bond film is the thrilling cities, the faraway places with strange sounding names.
However, they did have some scenes in mountains.
Spectre. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but
that's which gave it a nice 70s vibe.
Yes, and I agree. And some of the advanced publicity stills of Bond on those mountains and you're thinking, we're going to have a ski chase. I am so excited.
A ski chase.
We're going to have a ski chase. We haven't had a ski chase in years.
Car chase.
And it didn't. It ended up being a hokey plane car chase.
Yes.
And it was disappointing.
Yes.
That was disappointing.
Yes.
I was disappointed.
I mean, there's a couple of interesting things. And I think, like, you know, an anatomy, and it, to be honest, car chases are quite hard to get wrong. And Spectre has a fantastic one. When you've got Dave Astuta's character chasing down Bond in the car. And that one is just a fantastic car chase. Again, beautifully shot. There's nothing you can fault Spectre in that. But actually, I just wanted to pick up on one thing that Terry mentioned, Graham, which was tempo. And I think that's a really interesting thing when you dive into the anatomy of a Bond film. Because again, when I look at some of the Bond films where I don't think they've managed to pull it off, when you start kind of, what's a good Bond film? It's really evenly paced and it's like a good gig. It knows when to dive down for that bit where people need to nip to the toilet. but it also gets to that point where it keeps the energy going in a way, again, kind of films potentially like Diamonds Are Forever and For Your Eyes Only, which I think for all of us would probably move towards the bottom of if we're, you know, ranking Bond films in order. Whereas, you know, films, even like a film which has a little bit of kind of different or a bit of grit or kind of is a bit downbeat, say something like License to Kill, that's got a fantastic tempo to it. It never really lets up. And even in the kind of slower moments, there's an undercurrent of menace in the tempo as well.
Yeah, well, License to Kill is a great film for that. But I think what we look at, what we return to a lot when on this podcast is the music, and the music obviously helps. And of course, when so many of the films were scored by the same guy in the same way, then that really does help you feel at home with them. And it's what everyone who's written a score ever since has had to, well, I suppose they would say work with, but also fight against as well, if they want to stamp their own brand on there.
Mm.
And also as well, as you said, when we were talking about David Arnold, how much they loved the franchise themselves. Now obviously Dave Arnold was a massive fan of Barry. And so he just got into it straight away. But when you see some guys could come in and they bring their own interpretation of the music along. If it's someone with obvious talent like Marvin Hamlisch comes in and puts his own brand on there, but also keeps everything else that's really good, gives something that is really of a time, may not sit so well now with modern ears. But it is one of the best soundtracks, isn't it?
I agree. I also agree that in the modern sort of like audio aesthetic, it's not actually a term. But I think to modern ears, it's not popular. It's not fashionable. But it will have its time again. I mean, Spider Love Me will have its time again. People will people are always reassessing according to modern trends and modern tastes.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of like Spider Love Me is kind of out of that at the moment. But it'll come back around again because all of this stuff does, and it's a quality film. I agree with you also. I mean, it's interesting also because you're talking about still keeping it fairly modern. The last two soundtracks are by Thomas Newman, who is a Sam Mendes guy. He is Sam Mendes' guy, so he's not back for the next one. I thought that Skyfall was cracking.
Mm.
Although it's always disappointing when the composers don't lean too much on the Bond theme, because I love the Bond theme and I love hearing the different variations, and I love hearing good musicians interpreting that theme.
It's, and it can gives go me through pleasure. Ages. That's what people like George Martin and Marvin Hamlisch did. You say, you can update this.
Gosh, George Martin's James Bond theme is just a thing of absolute beauty. But for Spectre, yeah, a lot of those cues are just rehashed, and that was also disappointing. I'm really interested to see what Hans Zimmer does for the next movie, for this movie, because that's big news. He is comfortably the number one film score composer right now. It's a big leap for James Bond for Eon to get him in. That is a big thing. But yeah, so I mean, you know, a decent score is essential to any decent James Bond film. And this is where the For Your Eyes Only lets it down, because Bill Conti, who was a well-established, hugely respected, you know, this is the guy who composed the Rocky theme, no mug. But he was clearly briefed to do a contemporary kind of early 80s funky kind of, you know, score. And I think it kind of backfires in a lot of places, and it's really, really sort of like unlistenable. But other parts of that score are actually really, really nice. The extended version of that score is really, really nice.
So what are we saying then? Are we saying that for a good Bond film, it's got to rely on the cues, on all the Barry cues, but also got to be down with the kids?
Yeah, it has.
I think it has as well. Like as Terry said, even when you've got slow films, you've kind of got that tempo that kicks up. And the other thing that I'd actually like to add in as an anatomy of a fantastic Bond film is a recurring, and let's stick with audio for the minute, is that recurring kind of little Bond audio vignette, the motif that will keep coming back in, and you keep hearing it back. And if I can give one film which I think does that fantastically, is actually The Living Daylights, because it uses the Bond theme, but it also has the Pretenders in there as well. Mm-hmm. And they keep coming back, and they're fantastic cues that just kind of get you sort of, you know, something's going to happen, because you hear, like, you hear the Pretenders, Where Has Everybody Gone come in, and you know what's going to happen. You know something bad is going to happen. And then you've kind of got the Bond score, which kind of little, kind of vignettes of it keep coming all the way through. And that to me is what is almost the anatomy of a really good Bond film. And you look at almost kind of probably right the way back to especially kind of Goldfinger, which does that incredibly well. And that, as we've so often said, will set the template for it. But it didn't just set the template in action and kind of plot and character and everything else. It set the kind of standard in terms of getting that film into a place where you knew what was coming, but you didn't know what was coming. And that kind of, that tension. And the films for me that don't sort of adhere to that anatomy, and there's some really obvious ones, Die Another Day is probably the biggest example, just almost completely disregard that. They've forgotten what is that essential part of the anatomy of a Bond film. And obviously, I've, rather than asking a question, I've just checked out a statement there. But I'd be interested to know where, Terry, you feel on that as well, because especially I know this is very much in your kind of area of knowing those little lovely bits of soundtracks and audio vignettes in there.
Yeah, I could do a whole mini series of monologues just on the James Bond soundtracks, because I've heard it. And it's interesting because Die Another, of all of the ones that I've listened to, Die Another Day is one of the ones I've listened to the least. Interestingly, even though I'm a big fan of like what David Arnold has done, but I think I think that they get that movie wrong on pretty much every level. I'd like to raise that just before is GoldenEye, of course, is an acknowledged Bond classic, but it's well known that it's very few people will defend Eric Serra's soundtrack to GoldenEye. I just wonder whether you had a view on that.
Well, I have a view on GoldenEye because I played GoldenEye so much and they used a lot of the music there.
Yeah.
And so that takes me back, the music from that and a lot of the soundscape of that film takes me back to the Nintendo 64 game, which you know, occupied a lot of the late 90s for me. So that shows you where Bond goes into a new dimension, where you're going into other media. So as we were talking about, we've got audio, and now we've got video games as well. The flavour of Bond is sprinkled on. Yeah, I do love that soundtrack, and I think it's got Bono and the Edge and Tina Turner do a really, really
good song.
Yeah, I've always told you about where they missed the chance of putting the Bond theme in right at the opening scene, didn't they?
Yeah,
but you know, it's okay. Yeah. Sometimes you got to have these missed cues.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because they quite famously they replaced some of that score and got. I'm afraid I don't remember his name. I apologize. He's not listening, but I apologize for not remembering his name. But like the tank chase in St. Petersburg is scored by someone else.
Yeah.
Because I think at that point the producers have gone, this is not a James Bond.
Now we've got to get the bird up.
We need to get something that's recognisably Bond to bring this back in here, because it's a new actor.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, it's funny because we saw Pierce as a new actor to Bond. He was. It was his first Bond gig, but he'd been so associated with the role for so many years that... It wasn't like he was a new actor. I felt he'd already been there. Anyway, that's a slight aside. But you do have to, when you're bringing a new actor in, you need to, I think, you like rely on the score, on the Bond theme, just to reinforce to the audience that they're watching a James Bond film and they're watching an authentic experience.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because when you think about it, when you get, you've got Daniel Craig's first one, it's obviously Chris Cornell's song, the real big punchy song that okay, you've got your doubts about this Bond, but look, you're watching a Bond film right now. Look, those opening credits are more Binder than Binder, aren't they?
Absolutely.
It really goes in there.
Because it's a reboot movie.
Yeah.
It's building up to the fact that it's almost like it's saying we're starting as narrative. This isn't a James Bond. This is the formation of 007.
Yeah.
The creation of 007 as a character, as a franchise. So you're kind of with no gun barrel sequence and, you know, I mean, understated pre-credit sequence, certainly for, you know, a fight in a bathroom, you know,
black and white as well.
But then they go straight to the big, this is a Bond film, you know, you're watching a Bond film, look at the credits, look at this. But actually, we don't really get to know 007 isn't formed as a character, if you like, to the audience until that moment when he's puts on that Baroni suit, stands in the mirror, and David Arnold just hits the James Bond theme there. And it's a beautiful, it's one of the many reasons why Casino Royale is one of the best James Bond films. But it's the best James Bond film and one of the best films of its genre as well. And it just said, and here you go, it was just that little, like, nothing... big, just a doom, doom, doom. Yeah. And you think, here we go, and there he is.
He does the same in Skyfall, doesn't he? When they open up the garage to show the DB5.
Yeah.
And it's just two notes, and I think he's lifted them almost from the opening sequence of Goldfinger, isn't he?
I think you're right. Yeah, I'll have to look back and remember.
It's a...
It's nice.
Brilliant. And it takes you right. And if you're Bond nerds like us, like all you need is those two notes, and you're thinking,
and you're
there
off.
You go. I'm Goldfinger now.
Yeah. Yes. That's a good deep dive. That is.
That is deep dive. But hey.
Yeah. Yeah. So music then, very much part of the anatomy of a Bond.
Music is part of it. But actually, I thought there was something I was going to kind of, because obviously we've talked a lot about modern. I'll still stick in the kind of modernish era, because talking about Casino Royale and talking also about GoldenEye as well. And I think GoldenEye is a really interesting one, because the rest of the Brosnan films, I think it's fair to say, are not amongst the most loved by Bond aficionados. But GoldenEye is widely sort of acknowledged as a really great Bond film. Now, this is obviously is that point where you reboot and you've got a chance to do something a bit different with it, and kind of more Dalton, Craig as well have all had their ways of doing it. But GoldenEye is a really fascinating one, because it comes in of such a long hiatus for Bond. And you've got those, you know, you've almost got to reestablish a little bit of what, remind us why we love Bond and why Bond is great. So what I'm going to ask, and Graham, for you on this one, what are the elements of GoldenEye that you think you'd go, you know what, that is quite clearly in the DNA of Bond, it's the anatomy of Bond, that perhaps for some whatever reason starts getting a bit lost from Tomorrow Never Dies onwards?
With GoldenEye, it does seem to package everything in a box to say, right, this is Bond stuff, this has got damsel in distress throughout the whole thing, but she's strong. She's a strong 90s woman-ish, mm-hmm. running around in a short skirt and a little blue cardi. Also, you know, you've got this huge weapon in outer space. That's nice. You know?
Massive weapon.
And you've got a few chases in there. And as you say, like, obviously they've peppered that up with a bit more old school Bond theme going on in there. And you've got a variety of villains there. You've got the villainous female henchman, which is quite good. You've got the former 00 agent. So has Bond met his match? You know, which has been like the sort of like tagline to like so many other films beforehand. So it does actually take elements of characteristics of people from other films. Like you could look at Trevelyan and say, oh, there's a bit of Scaramanga about him, because he's very much in the same mould as Bond, but he's just not that much of a Bond. And so it's got all that thing going all the way through it, where there's a lovely roller coaster of a story there.
Mm.
And it comes out with a nice big set piece finish.
It's got a plot as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And a lot of the subsequent ones didn't really have any good. The plot was a bit...
It's more of a bunch of stuff that happened.
Yeah, action set pieces strung together.
And also as well, in GoldenEye, all the actors are used perfectly. And in the subsequent films, that does not happen.
No, not necessarily.
The reason Die Another Day is not a good film, it is great for the first half an hour.
Yep.
It really takes Bond into a different place, but you still know you're watching a Bond film.
Hmm.
But then it goes off somewhere where it becomes a parody. It becomes even worse. It's like, the way I look at it is Airplane came out in 1980 and was a parody of all the airport films that have preceded it. But the airport film that had immediately preceded Airplane was Airport 79. It was called Airport 80 in the UK.
Because
it didn't get released for a year. and it was garbage. The Concorde. And it was utter garbage. And it was virtually a parody of itself, wasn't it? And I think this is what we've got, because here's the obligatory Odd Job Pod Austin Powers reference. But this was in the middle when Austin Powers was being made. And then all of a sudden you've got this parody film, really, that tries to harken back onto all these other Bond films, but fails miserably. When the Bond films always harken back to references in other films.
Mm.
You don't need to stick them in there as say, all of this is a reference to this film. If you know your Bond, you'll see the references to other films, or you'll see where they've borrowed an idea from.
Plus the shocking CGI as well.
Oh, the CGI was awful. And I suppose that's... But, As we say, they do try and move it forward.
Mm.
I mean, going back to the opening sequence, which is something else we should always say, the title sequence, we should always say that's something that helps you know you're watching a Bond film. And the thing is that all right, a lot of the opening sequences before are basically just getting a load of models to wander around without any clothes on, with a blue filter and some floaty graphics around them, or you just project the scenes from the film onto a naked woman. Yeah, you know, why not? You know,
why not?
It was the 60s. It was a different time. It was a different time. But now, obviously, you've got changing attitudes. And so you don't necessarily do that, but you can come up with ideas that get that same sort of artistic feel. Mm. I think the opening sequence to Skyfall is brilliant. I think the opening sequence to Spectre is pretty good as well, and it gets you involved into that film, and it suits the music as well. And that's what you always got to see. You're going to see a very, very similar title sequence with this song as well, I'm convinced.
I think that we can't understate the importance of the things like the gun barrel sequence, the things like the Morris Binder style credit sequences. These are essential components to a James Bond movie.
And you see them on every Netflix series now as well, don't you? These sort of like high-end title sequences now, all very artistically done and overlaid.
He really did. He paved the way, Binder. You know, I mean, he's a genuine translator. And it's one of the rare examples of where James Bond sets, stylistically, in a design point of view, sets the tone for others to follow, and sets off a whole sort of like, you know, sub-genre of design that's been pioneered by Morris Binder and also to an extent as well, but in a different fashion, Ken Adam as well, which we've talked about on this and other podcasts as well. So that also, I think, plays into just the general look and feel of what a James Bond looks like.
Yeah.
And an Eon production James Bond looks like. I mean, it's possible that we will lose that. I think there's a good chance that in the next few years, maybe even by the time the next movie comes on, there's a good chance that a major studio will buy James Bond. And then we will really know the test of how strong that design, you know, that what's the kind of that kind of landscape that is the environment, the ecosystem of a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
The look, the feel, you know, the sound of it. You know, how much of that is owned by Eon and the studio and the people who have spent years and years making these movies. You can tell what a James Bond film looks like. You know, we're watching a James Bond film when you see it, even if, like, you know, Roger Moore's not in it, you know.
Yeah, but it's
does that make sense?
Yeah, it is. You've got that arc. You've got gun barrel scene, high octane opening sequence.
Yeah,
Morris Binder titles with a lovely stirring track.
Yeah,
and then that soothes away.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden you're walking into M's office.
Yeah,
and having a chat.
You're setting they're setting up the movie. So it's either exposition. Yeah. Exposition time, in M's office.
Yeah, or, if you haven't got any popcorn, you can go and get it.
Because we don't need to know the plot. Let's just go and quickly nip out and take a slash and then come back. You know, I mean, it's different now. They don't make them like that now. But I mean, it's, you know, and you know, things like, you know, the Q headquarters, and even today, even with modern Bond films, you know, there's a bit with Q, and oftentimes in Q's office, you know.
Yeah.
Even they still do that now.
Mm.
It's still, that's an enduring thing throughout the 50 odd years of the franchise, is a trip to Q's.
With comedic things going on in the background.
Yeah, even now, they still do that. And that still works. Yeah. That still works, which is amazing, really, when you consider the age of the franchise and the way that...
I think it's like, I mean, we're picking out a few more things in there, as well as the kind of tempo and the sound and soundtrack and song and the audio that sits in there and the aesthetic that we've discussed as well. So here's an interesting question. So take a film like, for me, one that I wouldn't ever put anywhere near the top of my list. I'm not a massive fan of it. It's fine, but it just doesn't do it for me. And that is You Only Live Twice. But actually, I was thinking about this before I came on here. If I tried to break down this film, it has almost everything I'd expect from a Bond movie, but I wouldn't ever put that as a great film, and not compared to sort of other ones around. And it kind of gets up to a point, but there's something that doesn't quite get it over the line. Now, this might just be my own personal preference within there, but like, Terry, What kind of, if you take, say, a film like You Only Live Twice, what is that little bit that you think that is not quite, maybe not quite there when you compare it to, and again, probably same for maybe even something like Thunderball, which again, you'd look at it and it has everything that you want in there, but it falls perhaps slightly short when you compare it to other films that kind of sit either side of it, like, you know, you've obviously got Goldfinger, you've got From Russia With Love, you've got On Her Majesty's Secret Service, you've then got, you know, film going a bit further on, like Live and Let Die and Try and Spy Who Loved Me, all those films which we kind of probably go, yeah, you know, that's like the ones that we'd really love, you know, we love watching again and again and again. But films like Thunderball and You Only Live Twice, just there's everything in there, but yet there's a little je ne sais quoi that is not quite there for me.
Yeah, there's, I love You Only Live Twice and actually find it an incredibly watchable movie. I know exactly what you're saying. I understand the criticisms of it because then I think it's just simply because the plot is just not terribly strong. There's not a great deal of intrigue going on there. There's not a great deal of enthusiasm from the actor. I mean, I think it's kind of established that Sean was, you know, a little bit, it was essentially his last movie. Dialing it in.
Yeah.
But I think also, I mean, it just things just didn't work, but they have some absolute iconic and classic elements, visual elements going on in that movie. You've got the Little Nelly sequence. You've got the first appearance, effectively, of Blofeld. You know, you've got Dodd, the classic Pleasance, Blofeld as well.
Classic complex attack as well.
Yeah, underground comics. So you've got like peak Ken Adam going on there. And then you've also got like, you've got the piranhas in the pool. Mm. You know, I mean, that.
Captain Space.
It's just got all of the, in terms of you're looking for the anatomy of a Bond movie, then almost everything is in there. It's got a beautiful score.
Mm.
It's my favourite, second favourite Bond song is You Only Live Twice by Nancy Sinatra. It's better than Goldfinger. It's better than Goldfinger. It's got all those elements, but what possibly sums up the lack of energy in that film is the fight on Kobe Dock sequence, which is beautiful,
yes,
but clearly it's like, look at what we can do.
Yeah,
I'm sure we've said this before.
This is their equivalent of CGI, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They're saying, we've got this budget. Huge. We're a massive, successful franchise, and we can do these amazing things with great skilled filmmakers with all the resources. We can go to Kobe and we can make an action sequence there. Never mind the fact that it's actually not terribly good. But look, helicopters. Look at us. We can film from a helicopter and we can go out. And it's, I mean, it is aesthetically beautiful, but just not a, you know, You Only Live Twice is an installation. It's a beautiful example of 60s filmmaking, of high-end 60s filmmaking to the highest possible production values.
It is
but
amazing.
It's not actually an adventure story. It's short.
Yeah, it is quite a nice experiment in filmmaking there when everyone is going closer in on hand-to-hand combat. Bond was pulling out to about a quarter of a mile away. Their directors were like you know, so far away from the action.
Yeah.
There he is, that small speck down there, beating the crap out of goons.
Really interesting because, I mean, obviously, you know, it's you've got your Bruce Lee movies running alongside you, which we are assuming is what they're looking at and thinking, what are you trying to bring about there? But you could tell there was no expertise in making martial arts action films in that movie as well. And that's another area where it goes down. But it's still, there are some great fight sequences. I mean, like the fight in the Sato Chemicals, when the big fight where they start fighting each other with sofas. That's cool. And of course, you know, and who can forget the Siamese vodka? I mean, killer line. But just like, the business with Aki and then Kissy Suzuki, that's all a bit jarring. And, you know, the callous way in which Aki is just cast aside once she's, you know, been murdered. It's sort of like, oh, crikey. I know that James Bond doesn't have a very high opinion of women, but my God, this is a bit strong. Doesn't really hold up at all. But yeah, so yeah, it's just lacking in energy, and I just think lacking in focus is what I would say. But in many ways, visually stunning.
Mm. It's always used as a rich source for people looking to satirize the genre, yeah. The genre,
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I suppose
perhaps,
that's.
I mean, that's. I was going to say perhaps there's a couple of things in there for me as well. Like, as you say, a rich source of kind of satire, which actually some of the films. The really good ones are quite hard to satirize because they're just so bloody good. And they're not as kind of trying to, I don't know. I think there's something for me with You Only Live Twice, where it's just that little bit of knowing and trying too hard. And I think you see that occasionally with some Bond films where they do feel like they know that they're, you know, they're clearly in a comfortable place. And there's just a little bit of we're trying, and I think Spectre suffers from that as well, that it's a bit too knowing and it's trying a bit too hard. But there also is actually, you know, for all the fact that Bond is, if you want to be really kind of brutal and perhaps even a little bit unkind, it is kind of, you know, high class pulp fiction, but you still need a great plot to make some great pulp fiction, yeah. Off the back of it. And this is, I think, where, you know, Bond is not necessarily ever going to win too many plot awards, but the ones that really hang together for me, and if you're looking at a good anatomy of a Bond film, is kind of, you know, they've really thought hard about the plot. They've not, the set pieces come around the plot rather than the plot is made around the set pieces. And that to me is where you've got the, you know, actually, good Bond films have really, really tight writing. And that's where some things, and this is potentially, and I know this is one area where we might disagree, but this is kind of where I start getting a little bit unraveled with a film like Moonraker, where they've clearly had a few set pieces in mind and start working into that. It's still a fun film, and I reappraise it a bit more. The more we've done this pod, the more I've picked up,
Gary,
on it a bit more.
But,
Gary, there is artistic integrity in a double-taking pigeon, okay?
I just don't know how you could possibly be opposed to a movie where, you know, a gondola turns into a hovercraft. I don't understand how you can have a problem with that. I don't see what, I mean, you know, if you can't appreciate the intricacies of the attempt to assassinate a killer by using a floating hearse first and then using the guys on the speedboat with the machine guns. You know, I mean, like, you know, obviously, you know, there is such beauty in the notion of, you know, we are going to, what we'll do is we'll try and kill him with a knife thrower in a coffin, you know, on a floating hearse.
If that doesn't work,
we've got the guys on the speedboat with the machine guns as a backup. Yeah. But really, that is like, there's more plan.
I don't know why you booked them.
That's plan F. It's not really a plan B. It's more of a plan F, guys.
I'd love to know how that one was. You know, I kind of imagine to a certain extent.
Oh, come on, Gary. Come on, Gary. You've been in enough meetings to know about this, how these things work.
You know, obviously you kind of go, and this is probably straying dangerously close into Clark's Star Wars conversation territory, but you've clearly got the, you know, you'll have the henchmen in there who are clearly pitching into whichever kind of minor boss that has to then pass it up the chain to approve. And like, guys, we've got a great idea for a plan here. Hear me out. I've got a few PowerPoints in front of me, or, you know, back in the day, they probably had like a couple of boards where they were kind of drawing out in there.
Overhead projectors.
You know, if this was, you know, you'd love to be sitting in on some of those pitches and going, okay, you know, do you really think the coffin is necessary? I mean, does the budget stretch to that at the moment? You know, we've got speedboats.
Yeah, well,
do we need
the
coffin for essential?
The lid opens up and then the knives all come out, yeah. You see. Look at the design on this thing. And, I mean, he spent months on this. Come on.
Obviously, surprise is the key here, right? So yes. I mean, would it not be wiser maybe to try and kill the target first rather than his gondolier fella?
Well, no, because you don't want him to get away. You don't know how strong that gondolier is. I mean, like, he could probably get...
No, okay, yeah. Yeah, no, fine, okay. Yeah. Fine, no, I think I'm ready to sign this off.
It makes him a sitting target, come on.
Definitely someone, whoever signed off that mission took a backhander. Because it's not, you know, I mean, really it's not. I mean, you go with the guys with the machine guns.
I think it was Salvatore the Coffin Maker, I think, he came up with the idea.
Hey, Salvatore.
Okay, so we have, obviously, plot, a level of, shall we say, balancing the absurd with a level of enjoyableism that's not too far parked into the absurd, which is obviously clearly a very clearly defined piece of anatomy.
Can I actually interject here, Gary? Because I've just something just popped into my head, and I just want to get with regards to that absurd chase. Okay, this is a movie that ends in space. In space. With a space battle with space astronauts with firing space lasers at each other, set in 1979. So this is an absurd concept of a movie from beginning to end, really. And I would put it to you, artistically, that actually some of the ridiculous set pieces in Moonraker are setting the audience up for the absurdity of the denouement of the climax of the movie.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, even down to the having fights in midair, fist fights in midair. Yeah. You know, they literally at the beginning of that movie, James Bond is thrown out of an aeroplane.
Yeah,
without a parachute.
If you're the sort of person that says, "Oh yeah, but then it's fine," and then they go into space, I don't think you've been paying attention.
No. What happened with this movie? Everything it was perfectly reasonable. Until, no, I mean, it's got a henchman who has metal teeth, for Christ's sake. I mean, it's just not, you know, it is a piece of absurd theatre and that has to be appreciated as such.
Yes. And
which is why Gary's opinion on it is wrong.
I know, exactly. And that's why he has to come on board. And that's
shift your mindset. Yeah,
this is what the whole purpose of this podcast has been for all the years we've been doing it. It's just to turn Gary around.
on Moonraker.
Yeah. So that it becomes his. I mean, I think every year it's gone up a couple of notches on his from the bottom. And it's now mid table. And it's now going into the European spots now. It's almost there.
Europa League Bonds. Okay, well, here's a nice bit, and to bring it back from the utter absurdity of hand-to-hand combat in space, which pops up in Moonraker in 79. There is a little bit, Graham, that where you've got that knowingness that also comes within Bond, and for me, I think one of the greatest examples of knowingness, and this is where you've got that wonderful bit of, you know, a Bond that knows its anatomy and it knows its DNA and knows it can riff on can be summed up for me in one line, which is that never happened to the other guy.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, certainly. That was obviously something of in an opening scene when you're only being the second Bond as well, that no one, there hasn't been a handover before.
Mm.
These days, obviously, there have been a lot of Bonds.
Mm.
So people are expecting new Bonds. People are almost calling for new Bonds, aren't they?
They are. Yeah.
And so whenever you do get a new Bond, there is going to be cries of it, you know, not my Bond or whatever it is. Or
#not my Bond.
Yeah.
Okay. No.
Yeah.
We're going to get that, aren't we?
We are. Of course we are. Of course we are.
It's going to be awful.
And so, yeah, that knowingness, that breaking the fourth wall, I don't know, yeah, he doesn't do it again, does he? But so that's...
No, because I think by that, but yeah, it only has to happen once,
you say.
It's a big leap.
And of course, Roger Moore doesn't do it because he did it all the time in The Saint, didn't he? So that was, so...
Yeah, I mean, Roger was due to take that role earlier in the franchise's history, but was like Pierce Brosnan and Ronan Steele, Roger was tied up with The Saint and couldn't do the work. So so you ended up with George first, and then Sean Connery coming back or something.
Yeah,
it's all lost in the mist of time. But
yeah,
that's an important part of the franchise, I think, that pre-credit sequence with George Lazenby and the humour with which they deliver that and just say, okay, yeah, you know this is not Sean Connery. You're probably got your doubts about it. So let's just find a nice humorous way of introducing this new actor who's going to be, at the time, they thought would be with them for the next 10 movies, but actually only stayed for one. But so I thought that, and it also sets the tone for the inherent humour of of a James Bond movie. James Bond movies try not... A good James Bond film doesn't take itself that seriously because it knows it's doing absurd things.
No, you've got Roger Moore doing Barbara Woodhouse impersonations. I mean,
yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, which is interesting to square off because, I mean, like, also, in some places, it takes itself very seriously because, yeah. I mean, I think it was Lewis Gilbert who said, if you don't do these things with earnestness, then people will think that you're jokey. So it won't take you seriously. But, you know, so the scripted humour is very much a part of it rather than, like, being casual or and when the moment James Bond ignores those rules and it starts to take the piss out of itself.
Yeah.
Like with Die Another Day, for example,
yeah.
then all is lost. You know, the movie just falls to pieces because it just becomes a jumble of nonsense.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, take the action sequences, take all of these things and take them seriously. Work hard, make them look amazing, make it work, you know, but then inject it with a little bit of sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle humour. You know.
I mean, Octopussy is a really good example of that, isn't it? Where you've got things like the Barbara Woodhouse stuff, and you've got the you've got him sliding down the banisters, and then having to shoot off
that's a perfect example of what I'm you've just illustrated it in a way. I go, thank you for helping me get there. That is a very, very funny sequence.
Yeah.
It's also a brilliant stunt.
Yeah.
Technically, brilliant shot, brilliant stunt work. Yeah. Excellent stunt work there. And I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. And it's a gag as well.
Yeah.
So if you could do these things, you've got to do it really, really well. Mm. I mean, like, you've got the highest possible production values on these things in terms of the technical thing. I mean, you know, you can forgive poor acting and you can forgive, you know, hokey plots. But if the production values drop in a Bond film, then the movie is lost. And I
think there's a really interesting and almost an analogy of that, a very recent one. I don't know if either of you two have seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah, Brad Pitt's performance, which is in that film, is one of those performances that looks so easy, but is actually really hard to be that effortless. And I think that's kind of Bond as well, that when Bond gets it right, you almost don't notice because effortlessly everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody is taking themselves taking it seriously, but they're enjoying themselves. And there's a level of kind of, it works because it works. And actually the effort has been put in because, you know, like Brad Pitt's performance, he's clearly had to work hard at it, but what comes across on screen is so well done that it just almost has no effort. And the minute that you start suspecting potentially is a bit of effort in there, maybe to go back to again, You Only Live Twice, just that slight bit of moving it over the top more than anything else, and it feels like there's a bit too much of we're going to try and push all out for this. Whereas you look at I think Honor Majesty's Secret Service is a great example, and obviously that's a very unusual example in the Bond kind of canon, where you've got, you know, actually, they've had to work really hard at it behind the scenes, and they've had to get a lot of elements right in there. But what's on screen is a lot more effortless than say, the film that preceded it. And certainly, you know, if you're looking a bit later, it's a lot more effortless than a lot of the Brosnan films, which really are the ones which I think kind of suffer from almost feeling like they've got to try and do something.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah, because I went to see Honor Majesty's Secret Service at the Prince Charles Cinema quite recently. I saw a nice, really nice, clean print of it on a big screen for the first time ever. I'd only ever seen that movie on the telly. And that film is so gorgeous. I mean, particularly the Piz Gloria scenes, when you see on the big the mountain range and stuff like that, you think, oh, this film is so amazing. The interesting thing about that is that in many ways, actually, Honor Majesty's Secret Service was quite a troubled production.
Mm.
The location scenes were not... There was weather difficulties and logistical problems there that they had with the production of that film. And of course, you know, George was inexperienced and a bit of a troublesome character. He took Bernard Lee out horse riding, and Bernard Lee ended up falling off his horse. And,
yes.
You know, I mean, you know, there were concerns about, you know, the lack of experience and, frankly, lack of professionalism of the lead, you know, in that situation. And but you're right, Gary, it comes across as being, you know, an effortless amount. I suppose this is the editing and post-production as well. It has a big, big role in that. And it's also, going back to the music, it's got one of the best scores, probably, I would say, of all the James Bond films as well. As you know, it's probably still my favourite.
And a fantastic cast as well.
Yeah, and a great cast. It's a great movie. I love that. Anyway.
So I think we've kind of come into a really nice point. So, you know, we'll kind of start moving towards wrapping up, but we've gone through a lot of things, and I think we've kind of, rather than just saying, oh yeah, well, a good Bond film has to have a good villain, and it's, you know, it's got to have a great Bond girl. Just from what we've kind of chatted about over the last 45 minutes or so, Graham, what would you kind of almost take from going, you know what, perhaps describe what sits in kind of the DNA of Bond? Where do I think the kind of key points are that you know you're going to get a good Bond film? Not just the fact if you kind of see a train fight, you probably know that there's going to be something enjoyable in there, or, you know, a ski chase or something like that. But what are those kind of underlying bits in there which you would really go, you know what, get all these bits right and you're pretty much guaranteed a corker of a movie?
I think it's what Terry was saying earlier, and I think that's what we always got to go back to. It is that element of, for want of a better word, believability, or really escapism. It's that moment of where you will be in a situation which you'll see in any other film, but all of a sudden there'll be that little twist to say, oh yeah, of course, no, he's got that exploding pen, isn't he? and then he'll get away with it because it's he had an exploding pen in his head, or he didn't have one, and that so even when that sort of thing isn't there, like when we first see Q in the National Gallery, and he says, yeah, what you were expecting an exploding pen. So even when it's not there, it's still there, isn't it? So you've got that idea of funky gadgets, and the idea that you exist, you've joined a world where that sort of stuff can actually exist.
Establish the rules of the film to the audience as early in the film as you possibly can, and this is, I think, where the pre-credit sequence often plays a very, very big role. If it's a big spectacular, you know, guy skiing off a mountain off the edge of a mountain, you know, and then with revealing a parachute, Union Jack parachute, then you know you're going to be watching that kind of James Bond film. Yeah. If it's like, you know, a car chase through Istanbul, you know, trying to avenge the death of a dead agent and recover, you know, the knock list, you know, then, you know, you're thinking, well, we're going to be watching more of a more grounded, authentic spy caper movie. And I think that pre-credit sequence helps, usually sets the tone for the kind of movie that you're likely to see. This is where Die Another Day falls over again, of course, because we get a very Fleming grounded, you know, like, you know, captured, tortured kind of war, you know, kind of this is going to be quite hardcore, and then he ends up with like the villain wearing a sort of like stupid Iron Man suit, you know, and some of the worst CGI you'll ever see.
Yes.
So, I mean, establish the rules. Like, this is going to be, the next 2 hours are going to be absurd, or they're going to be, you know, they're going to be authentic, or they're going to be grounded, or, you know, all that kind of thing. And then the audience is probably at that point ready to accept whatever is put in front of them.
Yeah.
including fights in space.
I think that's it. I mean, that's what we always got to come back to. When Fleming was writing these books, and I go back to Simon Winder's book, The Man Who Saved Britain.
Fine book, brilliant book.
And his whole point of it was the fact that when Fleming was writing these books, this was the 1950s. There wasn't a lot of money going around. People lived very drab lives in drab old rainy England, And yes, exotic locations were exotic. Mm. No one went. No one even went to Spain. So, this is the world it came about. And Fleming's books provided that escapism. And as the films have gone on, that's gone on to provide more escapism for people. Bond still exists in a world that we don't go to.
No,
it's still somewhere where very rich people, very beautiful people, hang out in. And yeah, some people do live in that world, and they probably have as much fun as Bond does.
Mm.
But it does take us there, transport us there. It also makes it a fantasy world as well. So because you want to imagine being Bond, or you want to imagine being with Bond.
Mm.
And that is what it still does. And that's what that's the essential thing about it, is Bond himself, is the fact that Bond has to be to tick all those boxes. And the world around him just is one of almost his creation. It's one that emanates from him. It's his name on that iconic theme tune, isn't it? So yes. That's where we go, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. And you know, if I had to wrap up in there, for me, it would be that Bond in itself, it plays best when it knows, almost like you've got that establishment, you've got that setup, and it knows what it's trying to be, and it knows what it's trying to be as a Bond film. And even if you take some of those films, which I like, and I would put You Only Live Twice in there, but also a film like, say, License to Kill and A View to a Kill as well, they're trying to be films that aren't necessarily Bond, whereas the better ones are ones that kind of see what's going on, they react to it a little bit, but they don't try and be those films, whereas, you know, License to Kill very much feels like it wants to try and be Lethal Weapon or something like that.
Mm.
Conversely, obviously, this then, you know, obligatory Odd Job Pod mention, and we are getting towards the end of it, and I'm amazed it's taken it this long. Conversely, you then get a film like The Rock, which obviously is trying to be Bond. It is essentially James Bond, but is trying to do everything to say it's not James Bond in every other way. But if you were probably, again, we've said this so many times, we do a podcast on The Rock, and we would probably break down the anatomy of The Rock, and it would be a James Bond film in any other word.
Yep.
But yeah, so I mean, I think those kind of get it to a place where, you know, you've got that seriousness, but not too seriousness, knows exactly what it is, doesn't matter what you kind of put on top of it. If you get those core fundamentals right, you've got a cracking Bond film. And gents, I suspect this is what we are hoping, praying for, to go back to the topicality of when No Time to Die comes out. And let's face it, it's got a promising start insofar as they've used the word die in the title.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it is an out of the box title, isn't it? No Time to Die.
Yeah.
But that's probably because they thought, well, we're running out of time and we still haven't thought of a name of this movie.
We've got no time to think of a good
No time to think of a film. No time to think of a title. Yeah.
Yeah. And they probably didn't consult Daniel Craig on the title on this one. Daniel, what should it be called? Quantum of Solace 2? Okay, right. We'll leave that to one side. I think at this point we've just come to the end of our anatomy, our DNA, our dissecting of Bond. If Bond was on the table, and obviously we want Bond to keep on going for a long time, because obviously we need material, we need content for this podcast, so we don't want Bond to die and be dissecting it ever more. But we are obviously, this is the anatomy of a Bond film. Be fascinated, you know, this is obviously a lot of opinions, and as we've established, there are opinions which are right and wrong, especially around the likes of Moonraker. Mm-hmm. I'll let you decide who is right and who is wrong on that one, dear listener. But if you have opinions and strong opinions and opinions with a capital O, please do get in touch. Double O opinions, if you like. And you can get in touch via Facebook, and you can also get in touch via Twitter. Just look for Odd Job Pod. And if you like this podcast, please do subscribe, tell people about it, or just put an angry subtweet on Twitter, and I'm sure we'll probably hunt it down and know exactly what you're talking about at any given point in time. Just remains for me to say thank you very much to Graham Sibley.
Thank you.
And thank you to Terry DeFello.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listener. Odd Job Pod will be back with more podcasting. We may fit in another one before No Time to Die, or we might just let ourselves percolate before said film comes out in April. Until then, hope you've enjoyed it. Hope it's inspired you to go back and look at a couple more Bond films, perhaps ones that you might want to pick apart the bones of and the anatomy of. Until that time, thank you very much. Enjoy your vodka martinis. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.